Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, producer Jonah Primo here. We are very excited to announce our first live event. Emil and Lloyd will take the stage at the Sydney Writers Festival, joined by philosopher AC Grayling and art historian and video content creator Mary McGillivray. And they'll go head to head on the topic of whether or not we still need books. That's on Friday, the 24th of May at 7:30 p.m. in Carriage Works, Sydney, and there's a link in the description of this show for tickets. You can also Google something along the lines of Principle of Charity, Sydney Writers Festival, and it's the first page to come up. If you like what you hear today and want to help us on our mission to inject curiosity into difficult conversations, the best way to do that is to leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome to Principle of Charity. I'm Lloyd Vogelman, and I'm here with my cousin and buddy, Emil Sherman. We're here to inject some generosity and curiosity back into our conversations. Principle of Charity tells us to seek the truth, not win the fight. To first put aside our own views and try to understand the other viewpoint before we instinctively reject it. Emil, my Principle of Charity personal challenge today is triggered by my rereading of one of my favorite authors, Robert Wright, who wrote a brilliant book on Darwin and evolutionary psychology. I'm reminded by him that natural selection did not design our minds to see the world clearly. It designed our minds to have perceptions that would help ensure the transmission of our genes to the next generation. In the natural selection calculus, being right 1% of the time in matters of life and death can be worth being wrong 99% of the time. So for me, as a swimmer, being right about sharks 1% of the time will save my life. But often we take the same calculus when things are not about life or death. And so on occasion, when we debate others who have different views to our own, being right starts to feel like a matter of life and death. And the Principle of Charity personal challenge this week is, are you mindful that being right is not always a matter of life or death to you or to others when you debate them? And the advantage of knowing this, Emil, is that it may provide you with the tools to argue both more objectively and more clearly. Emil, what's our topic for today?
Thank you, Lloyd. Our topic today is, are Jews white or people of color? Now, this may seem like a strange question to ask, whether Jews are white or people of color. In an ideal world, of course, or ideal at least for most of us in the multicultural liberal West, it shouldn't matter and nothing should ride on it. But race, ethnicity, and politics have always been intertwined. And this question takes us to the thorny heart and some surprising places in the battle lines in racial politics. For the past couple of hundred years, it has been the far right in the Anglosphere who've been most consumed by this question. For them, Jews are absolutely not white, nor are they merely a religion or ethnicity. They are a dark Middle Eastern racial stain on the Christian Anglo-Saxon whiteness who need to be expelled in order to preserve the purity and supremacy of the white race. Whether it's the Nazi definition of Aryan purity or the Ku Klux Klan's white supremacy or any far-right movement inspired by them, Jews are very much non-white. The liberal left and right, however, has by and large defined itself through its intolerance of those sort of racist beliefs, trying to look past the color of one's skin to the content of one's character, to quote Martin Luther King. Liberals have therefore downplayed race and ethnicity as maybe of interest in our personal and cultural sphere, but unwelcome in our social and political landscape. However, as we know, the progressive left has over the last decades increasingly seen racial identity as a fundamental weapon in the assault on structural racism and unconscious biases. It sees racial blindness, once a virtue, as a mask for the mechanics of privilege that those groups in power continue to perpetuate upon the marginalized. And so, according to this view, we need to wake up to those forms of oppression by acknowledging the sins of our white privilege, or as a person of color, finding ways to challenge white dominance. Jews are seen within this progressive left narrative, for reasons we'll discuss in this episode, as privileged. And it follows almost de facto then that they are white, as being of colour is reserved for the marginalised. So it seems today that the rather unusual question of whether Jews are white or people of colour, a question that the liberal centre has for so long argued is irrelevant, is now back on the agenda for both sides, with both the far right and the progressive left drawing a lot of meaning from the question, and with Jews seemingly on the wrong side of each of their equations, as non-white for the far right and quintessentially white for the progressive left. With all that said, what actually is the truth of it all? Where do Jews really come from? Are they white or people of colour? And how should we deal with the ethnic diversity within Jewish populations, with differences between Ashkenazi, Sephardi and Mizrahi Jews? To be honest, even as a Jew myself, I find all of this incredibly confusing. To help answer this question, Lloyd, we have two guests with two very different lenses. Our first, Simon Sebag Montefiore, is one of the world's leading historians. He will outline the historical, archaeological and genetic consensus and any counterviews on where Jews come from and how Jewish populations have moved through the ages. We then have David Baddiel to help with the cultural and political significance of this question and to explore whether Jews are privileged enough to be deemed white, regardless of their Middle Eastern heritage. Finally, as I've said, I am Jewish of Ashkenazi heritage and so have literal skin in the game. So I'll do my best to mitigate any unconscious biases or motivated reasoning on my part. Let's see how we go, Lloyd, and tell us a little bit about our incredible guests.
Emil, they are indeed incredible. Our two guests today are David Baddiel and Simon Sebag Montefiore. Both are well-known personalities globally and in particular the United Kingdom. Let me tell you about David first. David Baddiel is a comedian, author, screenwriter, and television presenter. He's pioneering in many respects. In 1992, he performed with Rob Newman at the Wembley Arena in the UK's first ever arena comedy show and was credited as turning, for the first time, comedy into the new rock and roll. David has had numerous TV hit shows, including the Mary Whitehouse Experience. And in the world of football, which I love, David is celebrated for his creation and presentation with Frank Skinner of two great football shows, one of which is the super funny Fantasy Football. More recently, David created and presented Confronting Holocaust Denial and Social Media, Anger and Us. David is a great writer. He's published 9 hugely successful children's books and 4 critically acclaimed adult novels. And most recently, he published the Sunday Times best-selling nonfiction polemic, Jews Don't Count. Of relevance for this show is that David's parents were Jewish, and his mother was 5 months old when she was taken to England by her parents in 1939 after the family fled Nazi Germany. Emil, our other guest, is Simon Sebag Montefiore. Simon is the internationally best-selling author of prize-winning books that have been published in 48 languages. His book, Catherine the Great and Potemkin, was shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize. Stalin, The Court of the Red Star, won History Book of the Year Prize at the British Book Awards. Young Stalin won the Costa Biography Award, the LA Times Book Prize for Biography, as well as the Kreisky Prize. On a personal note, Simon is descended from the well-known, wealthy Jewish philanthropist family, the Montefiores. Some of Simon's family fled the Russian Empire at the beginning of the 20th century to settle in the UK. Emil, let's bring on the guests.
Well, thank you, Simon and David, for joining us. Simon, a lot of people, many Jews included, are confused about who the Jews actually are as a people in historical terms. Most people know that they originally come from the land around current-day Israel and Palestine, with much of the land referenced, of course, in the Old Testament, which is the Jewish Bible and forms part of the Christian Bible. And then there's an understanding that the Jews were expelled from the region 2,000 years ago or so after the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. There's a sense that the Jews, by and large, went to Europe and sort of became white Northern Europeans and finally neurotic New York comedians or London comedians in the case of David. So I'd love it if you could just set out the truth of this all. You know, where do the Jews come from? What is their basic journey from the millennia ago to today?
Yeah, I mean, there was about 1,000 years when there were Jewish kingdoms in what is now called the Holy Land, today the state of Israel, where Judaism was worshipped around the temple in Jerusalem, the holy city. And in the 130s AD under Hadrian, there was a last spasm of Jewish revolt against the Roman Empire, which had really started at 70 AD when the temple was destroyed by Titus after a Jewish revolt again against Roman power. And then there was the beginning of a sort of diaspora when Jews moved away. They were banned from Jerusalem. Actually, they could still live in Judea, and there probably were always Jews there. But they then spread around in two directions, one, the Mediterranean, and two, eastwards into Babylon and what is today Iraq. And those communities that went eastwards lasted an incredibly long time, all the way until about 1950. Those that went into the Mediterranean lived in Italy, in Libya, in Spain, and the biggest community was in Spain, and that was the Sephardic community. The Sepharad, named after Sepharad, which is the Hebrew for Spain. In 1492, those Jews were expelled from Spain by the King of Spain for religious, racial reasons. And many of them went to Eastern Europe, joined Jews in Eastern Europe, and many others moved to the Ottoman Empire, where they were welcomed into what is the Arab world. And there they joined Jews like the ones we'd already discussed in Babylon and Iraq.
Or the Mizrahi Jews, in Babylon.
Well, they were Mizrahi Jews. They were also many of them Sephardic, of course, so just to be confusing. So there are three types of Jews.
Yes.
The Ashkenazi, the ones who moved to Poland, settled in Poland, probably in the Middle Ages.
And where were they before the Middle Ages?
They later went to the Rhineland in the Middle Ages. And in the Rhineland, and hence the name Ashkenazi, meant that they lived in Germany, but they also moved eastwards and they were in Poland, because Poland was one of the freest countries to live at that time. There was tolerance of Jews in Poland, and that's why there were huge Jewish communities. But those Jewish communities, by the vagaries of power politics, ended up in the Russian Empire in the 18th century. And that's why Russia and Poland had huge Jewish communities. And there was huge anti-Semitism from the Romanov Tsars in Russia, which created the refugee crisis that led to many things, but ultimately, those people provided many of the immigrants that created Israel. But the other half of the immigrants for Israel were created by the Mizrahi, who were the Middle Eastern Jews from Egypt, Syria, Iraq, Persia, Iran. And that's why in Israel today, of the Jews in Israel, and the Jews are 80% of Israeli citizens, because 20% of Israeli citizens are Arab and Druze Israelis.
Largely Arab.
The 80%, but of the 80% that are Jewish, over 50% are Mizrahi, in other words, Middle Eastern people.
Who've been there throughout from that original diaspora.
Who had been in the Middle East for 2,000 years.
And they were essentially refugees, expelled from the region after Israel's War of Independence, about 850,000 is my understanding, who then sort of fled into Israel from that period through the 50s and 60s.
The beginning of intolerance towards Jews, it didn't start with the Israeli War of Independence. In fact, there's a huge myth that the Ottoman Empire was this wonderful, tolerant, and the other Arab countries, Morocco, Iran, for example, that this was a wonderfully tolerant world where everyone lived happily. Actually, that's a huge myth. There were constant attacks on the Jews, but they were part. Their community was recognised, and they had tolerance to worship.
If you had a look back at history and go, who were more welcoming to Jews, the Islamic community or the Christian?
There was anti-Semitism in both. But nothing ever came close to the horrors perpetrated by Christian Europe in the form of the Nazis.
And just to sort of give a sense of the number of Jews in the world, the research I did, about 16 million Jews in 2023, about 75% Ashkenazi, with the balance Mizrahi and Sephardi. But in Israel, as you say, the balance tips in favour of Mizrahi Jews.
It's much higher. It's nearer 70% of the Jews in Israel are Middle Eastern.
At 1900, in the turn of the 20th century, the majority of people in the region of now Israel-Palestine were Arab Muslim, right? There was a small minority of Jews that grew over the period.
There'd always been a Jewish community in Jerusalem, in the Holy Land. Jews had always prayed there whenever they could.
Throughout the 1,000 years.
It's 2,000 years, throughout that 2,000 years. And to give you a small example, you know, the Western Wall, the Kotel in Jerusalem, the one of the supporting walls of Herod the Great's temple, is famous as the holiest place in the Jewish religion. But in fact, Jews traditionally prayed all the way around those southern walls of the Temple Mount. And the reason why the Western Wall is now the holiest part is because Suleiman the Magnificent, the Ottoman Sultan, said, who took a great interest in Jerusalem, said, actually, you know, these Jews are praying all the way around the Temple Mount. Let's give them a little section, which was about sort of 15 feet wide or, you know, or something like that. That's their section. They have to pray there, otherwise they're kind of messing up. They're messing up our holy place. So it's just a little example of how the Jews were given tolerance, but within limits by Islamic rulers.
I'd like to just get to the question of proof, because like my understanding is the story of Exodus itself, you know, Moses leading the Jews out of the bondage in Egypt to the promised land in Canaan, now Israel-Palestine, that has no basis in truth. So what proof is there that the Jews originally came from that region 2,000 years ago and that they practiced Judaism for the millennia before that?
Without going into endless detail about different steles and inscriptions, basically the Genesis and Exodus are unproven. King David is only proven by one inscription, which refers to the house of David, which is from about 100 years, 150 years after him, but proves that there was a kingdom of ruled by the David dynasty.
When was that?
I mean, he is supposed to have lived around 1000 BC. The Tel Dan stele is from about 150 years later. But by that point, and of course, King Solomon is also mythical. There's no evidence that King Solomon existed except in the Bible. But after that, where we are about 900 BC now, or 850 BC, there's quite a lot of this increasing proof that there is a Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And as time goes on, through that millennia, there's more and more proof. So there's not really doubt historically that there was a first Jewish temple destroyed in 586 by Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian emperor. And then a second temple, which was backed by Cyrus the Great, Cyrus and Darius the Great, the Persian great kings, and was then embellished enormously and rebuilt, really, by Herod the Great in the first century BC. The point is that the Temple Mount, all real historians and real archaeologists, I don't mean politicized, the politicized ones on either, who are on both sides, everybody agrees that there was a Jewish temple on the very spot where the Dome of the Rock now stands.
Yeah, and then as you get closer to Jesus' life, things become a lot more written about and proved. And
Jesus was a contemporary of Herod the Great. He was born roughly just when Herod the Great was about to die or had died. And the temple that he went to is written about in the New Testament with the moneylenders and where he had his circumcision, where he had his bar mitzvah. All of those, that was Herod's great temple, which was destroyed in 70, and of which the Western Wall, the HaKotel, is part.
I mean, the next sort of key proof that I think people look for is the Ashkenazi Jews of Northern Europe. How do we know that they descend from those Jews who you've described at the turn of the millennia?
Recent DNA research on all Jewish communities show that they are all, to a greater or lesser extent, descended from the ancient peoples of Canaan, as are indeed the Palestinians, in fact.
They share a lot of genetic, there's a lot of genetic DNA overlap, cousin, isn't there?
Obviously, the Sephardic Jews, the ones who are in the Middle East throughout the period, have much more Middle Eastern DNA than Ashkenazi Jews, but both have it.
And what level of interbreeding and marriage do you think there was in Northern Europe for those 2,000 years to keep that sense of genetic continuity?
Well, I mean, you never know what happens. You know, one's always discovering amazing stories of in one's own world of people who've had sex with people they weren't meant to. But essentially, the Jewish communities were incredibly separate. They married within themselves, and that's what's unique about Jewish history, really, because all the other peoples who were destroyed when their temples were destroyed, they basically vanished and sort of intermarried with their conquerors. And the Jews didn't do that. And for different geopolitical reasons, which David's written a lot about in his book, you know, Jews remained separate. And that was one of the great sort of cultural achievements of Judaism in a way. But it was also made Jews vulnerable, of course.
So, David, you know, we know that historical facts are one thing, and we've heard about the sort of historical consensus of the Jewish story very briefly. But then there's the political overlay where the facts are used to service different political ideologies. And we're in an unusual moment, aren't we, where the far right continues to see Jews as very much not white, as the sort of Middle Eastern dark stain on whiteness, as they define whiteness racially and want to see Jews as a race, with Jews therefore sort of indelibly non-white. Then on the other side, the progressive left sees Jews as white, as they generally view the world through the lens of privilege. And because they see Jews as doing well, they're therefore almost sort of deemed white and can't be of colour, regardless of where they might come from or appearance. I'd love it if you could just outline in a bit more detail how the far right and the progressive left see Jews within this sort of whiteness and people of colour paradigm, which seems to mean more than it should, in a sense.
Okay, so what you just outlined there is something which, in my book, Jews Don't Count, I call the phenomenon of Schrodinger's whites, by which I mean Jews are white or non-white, depending on the politics of the observer. It's quite a good analogy because there's a thing called the observer effect in physics, so I'm quite proud of it. But anyway, the point being that, yes, as you've just outlined, for centuries, by the far right, but different types of, you know, even Voltaire thought Jews were Asiatic and should be ejected from Europe. Jews have been seen as not part of whatever the central race is, and in Europe that would be white, Christian. Jews are seen as other, and then that's been co-opted in more modern times by the far right as, American white supremacists. Now, there's something called the Constitution of an Ethno-State, which I can't remember who wrote it now, but one of the principal American white supremacists now, the same people who are chanting the Jews will not replace us, specifies in its constitution for that ethno-state that Jews are not welcome in a modern white American state.
Sorry, that's interesting that even before the sort of far-right phenomenon, just in the high Europe of the 19th century, the Jews were seen sort of as the Oriental, yes, darker, swarthier.
That would definitely be the case. And racial, one of the key things in my book is that anti-Semitism is slightly miscategorized, not completely, obviously, because historically it's very important, but slightly miscategorized in my notion as religious intolerance. And obviously, historically, it's had enormous effect, the religious element of it. But I think anti-Semitism, particularly now, but has always primarily been a racial thing. And that, to choose a historical example, actually, when 150 Jews were massacred in York in, Simon, you might have to help me here, 1192?
Yeah, 1190, wasn't it?
1190. The massacre happened because some Jews had lent money to noblemen, and noblemen didn't want to pay that money back, so they spread a blood libel about Jews. This led to a mob a lot of Jews were hiding in a place called Clifford's Tower, and the mob demanded the Jews inside convert to Christianity. And most of the Jews in that tower committed suicide rather than convert, which is an example of what Simon was talking about earlier, of the immense stubbornness of Jews to give up their sort of identity. But meanwhile, about 7 or 8 did come out and say they would convert. By the way, I would have been one of those Jews. They were murdered anyway. And that's a key thing, because I think that even in 1190, people weren't that bothered about the fact that Jews prayed differently. What they were bothered about was the idea that Jews were other, and other is always scapegoated and feared and eventually monsters.
So that's the far right.
Yeah, well, that's the view that leads to Jews being directly, as it were, targeted by a malign idea of what they are, of which there's a relationship between, I would say, that sort of Christian hatred of Jews culture and the far right now. Meanwhile, on the other side, we have an idea of the whiteness of Jews. So whiteness is an incredibly important concept, and a very simplified concept by the left. Often everything that's bad is bundled into an idea of whiteness. And it's interesting to see how, I mean, particularly now, but you can see it in many other examples, how whiteness is applied to Jews. So, for example, when Jeremy Corbyn was head of the Labour Party, one of the things he got into slight hot water for was he supported a mural in London. And the mural was of... it had been done by a very progressive, very kind of like stick-it-to-the-man street artist called Mir One. And it was of men playing Monopoly on the backs of the world's poor, and the men are white, and the world poor are seen as brown and black, and they're sort of bent over, and there's a big monopoly board. And the men were all men with long beards and hook noses and with money and all the rest of it. And some Jews complained that this seemed to be a grotesque caricature of Jews in the kind of Der Stürmer Nazi imagination of Jews. And in his riposte to this, Mir One said, oh, I see some old white Jewish folk have got upset about my depictions of their beloved Rothschild and their beloved Warburg. An extraordinarily insinuating Goebbels-like thing to say, by the way. But the key phrase in that sentence is white. Why does Mir One feel the need to add the word white to that? It's to absolutely stamp the idea that as a progressive, these people do not belong in the area of vulnerability and concern that he as a progressive needs to be concerned about.
So why do the progressive left see Jews as white? What's the ideological underpinning of that view?
Well, I don't know if there is an ideological underpinning. I would say it's more of a sort of mass psychology, which is to do with an embedded idea, very, very difficult to shift in Western culture, that Jews are privileged and powerful and, you know, not vulnerable. Despite years of persecution, there is a looping and very dysfunctional relationship between the way that Jews are targeted and genocided and the idea that they are powerful and privileged. So, you know, this is fairly unique to Jews, as far as I could make out. Simon may be able to find another minority, but as far as I'm aware, it's only Jews who, when they are targeted, like I mentioned that money lending thing earlier, that goes all the way to the Nazis, who will tell you that the Jews were, you know, financing the collapse of Germany and owned the banks and all that stuff that was all not true. The way that Jews are targeted tends to be that they are in control and they need to be brought down from that control. It's this idea I talk about, that Jews having a dual status in the anti-Semitic mythology, that they are both low status in the way that all minorities are, which is sort of thieving and dirty and stinking and sort of vermin-like. And yet Jews have this other thing, which is that they are monstrously in control of the world somehow. And that idea shades into the left's general idea of capitalism. The left's general idea is that the capitalist is very close to the idea, and cartooned often, of the idea of the sort of scheming Jewish cigar-smoking fat idea. And that's very horseshoe theory. It's where right and left ideas of power become very similar.
Yeah, and I mean, this links obviously very nicely to your great book, Jews Don't Count, which, as you say, points to that, the fact that pretty much any other minority all seem to be protected from prejudice and racism by the progressive left, but Jews aren't seen as worthy. Mm. And despite the millennia history of anti-Semitism, they don't seem to count. And, you know, my reading of that book is you're not there to take exception with the beliefs of the progressive left. In fact, you seem to largely hold that worldview. Your argument is just that it's totally inconsistent for them to ignore Jews if they're so concerned with protecting minorities. Now, I confess, when I first came across your book, my reaction was that although I do have a number of issues with progressive left ideology, if you take that as the framework, then I felt like Jews should not count. You know, Jews are not specifically disempowered and marginalized economically, culturally, or politically in the West. And that is the framework of you know, the progressive ideology, to look at equality of outcome, who's not doing well, drawing a line between that and, you know, privilege and power. So in a sense, they shouldn't count in the way that white Christians don't really count for the progressive left viewpoint. But as I read your book, I did have a whole range of light bulb moments that really have challenged my thinking and changed my mind. I mean, I guess my question is, why should Jews count?
Well, the key element of that is I think at one point in the book, I say this is very un-Marxist to me, but fuck off about money in the notion that Jews are rich, because not only is it not really true that Jews are rich in terms of, you know, that when you compare them to other minorities, I believe, you know, there's one point, I don't really like statistics, and it's not really that kind of book, but I say that the most millionaires in America are Hindu, and yet no one, literally no one on the progressive left would say, well, it's okay to be racist, we should exclude Hindus from various types of anti-brown thing because they're doing very well. But what I really mean by fuck off about money is that it's an incredibly simplistic Marxist view of the world, that idea of, you know, structural dispossession or whatever is all that counts in history. Because, you know, I say quite straightforwardly, my grandparents in Germany were rich. They were industrialists. They owned a brick factory in Königsberg. I'm told they had a Rubens, but we can't find it because it got stolen, as indeed all their stuff did, and most of their family murdered because of a notion that they were rich. And the important thing about that is, as Simon said, is that is not the only event that's happened to Jews throughout history. It's an absolute looping, cyclical thing that happens to Jews, and presently at the moment there is a lot of, I mean, you know, there has been even before October the 7th, Jews are one of the highest in percentage hate crime enacted against Jews online. You can see an incredible amount of hate towards Jews. And in a way, that's the point, is that your notion that Jews are not suffering, for want of a better word, which, by the way, can be very patronising towards other minorities, that notion that they are desperately in need of allyship from sort of white Christian people. But anyway, put that to one side. The notion that Jews are not that, the Jews are comfortable, is what leads to them being attacked and being attacked in very extreme ways. So what I take issue with your basic, I don't think you're wrong, you're right, that is how the left see things. That is a fractional view of the world. The idea that a community might require protection is not just about whether or not they're doing okay economically. There are other ways in which a community can be vulnerable.
Yes, and I think what you pointed out to me was that even by the logic of the left's ideology, there are plenty of groups, like you mentioned, the Hindus and certainly Asians, you know, groups who may not be doing poorly economically or culturally as well, but are still seen as being vulnerable to racial attacks. And you talk about white privilege doesn't only refer to economic privilege, but it has to refer to safety. And there are many groups who you are never discounted if you're a member of another racial minority or ethnic minority. You know, you may not be doing poorly economically if you are vulnerable physically and your physical safety is in jeopardy. And when you look at the statistics that you mentioned, and I wasn't aware of the sort of level of these statistics, that the amount of hate crimes against Jews, how incredibly disproportionately high, I think at times five times the amount of hate crimes were directed against Jews as were Muslims. And that's not to say any hate crimes are good. It's just one could argue that Jews aren't in a bad way economically, but they could still be incredibly vulnerable and therefore in need of concern.
And also the idea that Jews are okay economically so we don't have to worry about anti-Semitism. That's essentially my book summed up in terms of how I see the left's attitude to Jews is historically unbelievably negligent. Because, you know, Jews are good. Jews are pretty good at surviving. You know, that's how we are here. That's how all of us are here, right? Because we shouldn't really have survived given the level of violence perpetrated against our ancestors. But somehow we have. And then that is mitigated against us, weaponized against us by the idea, oh, they're fine, so we don't have to worry about them. And by the way, I also relate it in terms of the left's attitude to minorities, not just to racial minorities. Another good example is gay people, gay men in particular. Gay men are, I believe, demographically a very, you know, well-to-do group. And, you know, again, the idea that that allows for homophobia, or that homophobia isn't really a big issue anymore, that is obviously something a progressive would never say.
Yeah, the issue you brought up in the book that you pointed to is about passing, which is used a lot in terms of straight and versus gay. And again, that was something that hadn't occurred to me. I thought, well, look, you know, I pass as white, and that is a form of privilege.
Yeah.
But you point out the sort of inconsistency there where nobody on the progressive left would feel like it's a morally good thing that someone who is gay needs to pretend to be straight, to pass as straight in order to feel safe. Yet there's an assumption that if you can pass as white if you're Jewish, but if you declare you're Jewish, if you hadn't have changed your name, as a lot of the, you know, my father-in-law changed his name from Solomon to Shaw, in order to pass more convincingly. If he hadn't have done that, he would have felt vulnerable to attack. So that is considered morally repugnant for the left to need to pass, even though obviously it is a form of privilege that one can, but it's not a good thing, and one needs to be consistent with how these things are.
The notion of privilege, Emil, is complex there. For a start, you can't pass as white, by the way. I say that you're obviously Jewish, as indeed am I. Simon, I'm not so sure.
I once could pass when I had an enormous amount of blonde hair.
Right, that's right. That's less so now. But also the Montefiore name, there is that issue. But I mean, but passing is a double-edged sword anyway, right? So, yeah, firstly, as I've pointed out before, that the idea that you can pass as a form of privilege is an odd one, given that empowerment is a very modern progressive concept, right? That's why we have pride, right? For LGBTQ people, pride is there because in the past, those people were forced in the closet. They were forced to stay in the closet and they weren't allowed to express themselves and their community or whatever. And now they are, and everyone celebrates that. But so were Jews. Jews were also forced to hide and forced into ghettos and not allowed to express themselves. And there's no Jewish pride. You know, I mean, there somewhere there might be, but we don't have marches that lots and lots of progressive people turn up to. So there's that. And there's also something else, which only Jews get. Again, one of the things about the way that I think about this is that I'm not talking about discrimination in a kind of like, oh, you know, we just have to look at it in a league table, what's worse than another. What I'm trying to do is specify the way in which anti-Semitism works and how that doesn't affect other minorities. That doesn't necessarily mean it's better or worse, but it exists. And it shouldn't be ignored. And one of those is that Jews are imagined by the far right as being everywhere and secretly everywhere. And there are many websites where far right people out Jews by saying, oh, look, there's all these Jews in the American government, or there's all these Jews in Hollywood, and you didn't know. And they can do this because of their ability to mix among us in a sort of malign way because we can't spot. And that is, at the end of the day, what leads to the Nazis putting armbands on Jews.
Well, Simon, politically and socially, you know, as we've discussed, so much rides on whether a group is seen as privileged or not. And there's a sense among many that not just that Jews are privileged, that they do well or positions of power, but they've always been this sort of powerful small clique over the centuries, maybe running banks and finance for kings. But could you give us a sense, what was it like for Jews in Europe in the, you know, 14th to 18th centuries, you know, before the Enlightenment, let's say? Did the average Jew occupy a privileged position or a marginalized position in society? How did they live, you know, back then?
Most Jews were poor, living in confined areas, ghettos, and restricted to certain professions, which included finance. They were not allowed to own land, which is what any kind of free person could do. Mm-hmm. And in fact, these sort of restrictions lasted in Europe well into the 19th century. In Britain, those restrictions lasted until the 1850s. And in fact, the parliament that passed the abolition of slavery, the parliament of 1833-34, passed the abolition of slavery and refused to cancel the restrictions on Jews going to Cambridge or Oxford, owning land, and et cetera, et cetera. So those kind of medieval restrictions went on much further than one would think. You mentioned the Enlightenment. Of course, during these periods, there were exceptional members of those Jewish communities who became, you know, Moses Maimonides became Saladin's doctor and was head of the Jewish community. Many of them were doctors who became leaders of their community because they had they were doctors to the king or the sultan. Others became lenders to kings. I mean, for example, Licorice of Winchester is a famous female example. And that's how the Rothschilds also started off. So into the 19th century, there were tiny groups of Jews who were serving as financiers or, you know, court Jews to rulers. But actually, they were such a tiny minority.
But what were the majority? The majority who sort of lived in the ghettos, which often had the, you know, the gates that closed at night. What were they doing, and were they better off or worse off than the average non-Jew out there?
They were worse off. They lived in pretty poor circumstances. They weren't rich. They didn't follow any of the cliches. But as David said, they were often blamed as the other for things that went wrong in the community. So, you know, either if you were on a crusade and you were about to go and kill all the Muslims you could find in Jerusalem, you might well kill some Jews on the way, because they were the closest other that you had access to. If there was a plague, you might well be accused of poisoning the water if you were in that community. And then people would burst in and kill a whole lot of you. And even into the 19th century, the blood libel was a regular weapon against Jews, invented in Britain, I'm ashamed to say, which was basically the idea that Jews were in some way or other killing Christian children in order to perform their diabolical rites and rituals. And, you know, that's one of those images from that period that we now see regularly put on posters around London today, used against Jews in a new kind of form of anti-Semitism. That was the Jewish destiny in the Middle Ages in Europe. But with Napoleon, and it wasn't really the Enlightenment, funny enough, it was Napoleon who really liberated Jews and said Jews should have equal rights. That's when Jews came out of the ghetto, and that caused a new change, an evolution in anti-Semitism, because instead of Jews being regarded as a sinister other, locked up in their little communities in towns and ghettos, in the 19th century, they became to represent another thing, which was modernity, democracy, the stock exchanges, newspapers, all the things that were regarded as destroying traditional societies. And of course, personified by the Rothschilds, for example. So that formed a new sort of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people associate anti-Semitism with the Holocaust, but probably don't have an appreciation for all the different forms that it's taken over the centuries and millennia. The idea that stuck with me, I think it might have been in an Henri Bernard Lévy book he wrote about Judaism or not, but it was the idea that the Jews are the quintessential other, and whatever structural and ideological rifts there are in society, the Jews are on the opposite side. And it, in some sense, it gives you a place as a Jew to view the inside, their benefits from being the other, but it's, you know, you always end up as the other.
You know, one reason why Jews are good at sort of storytelling and have, you know, disproportionately written and created things that the wider culture have enjoyed is, I think, Jews do exist in this position of being, you know, very much able to feel part of the culture, and we are, you know, whatever the passing thing, or we can seem to exist and assimilate within it, but then we always have 5% out of it, I think, partly because of this sense of insecurity. And that is a difficult position to be in when things go bad, but it's quite a good position to be in as observers, you see what I mean, as observers and storytellers.
But you're always told if you know, that you are the capitalist, as Simon said, when the conservatives are fearing that the Napoleonic changes are going to, you know, undermine the basis of their traditional society. And then, you know, the Jews are the communists as well. And then there are the colonialists. And then there are also, you know, the indigenous dark others that sit outside white society. Yeah. So,
I mean, just to sort of paraphrase David Baddiel, it's very bad when Jews don't count. It's almost worse when they do. And, you know, the trouble with the new narrative now is that Jews aren't just regarded as the other, that Jews are regarded as both the other, but also as having been the cat's paw, the intimate collaborators of empire and colonialism in the formation of Israel. That's a sort of new theme, really.
Sort of new. I mean, what I would say is that that's a turbocharged version of white and non-white idea of Jews as in Israel as being Mizrahi and essentially people of color, which they clearly are, a lot of them. That is not that is ignored by the progressive left to situate Jews, because essentially what they want to do is create a very simplistic idea of goodies and baddies. And goodies and baddies now essentially means white versus brown and black. And Jewish Israelis are seen as the hand of whiteness here. And another word for that is the hand of American colonialism. Those things are sort of indistinguishable, I think.
And British colonialism.
And British colonialism, yeah. Essentially, it's about power. In my documentary that I did about Jews Don't Count, Jonathan Safran Foer said, he was critiquing this view, but he just put it, saying, if you want to view the world, which I think is a boiling down of how the progressive left does see the world, as victimizers versus victimized, then it's always very hard to see the Jews as the victimized. That relates to white versus black and brown. It also relates to colonialists versus indigenous. There's always a binary. And the Jews, the point about Jews, they are a glitch in the binary. That's always the case. Jews are a glitch in the power binary.
You know, we probably should have started with this in a sense, but to answer the question of whether Jews are white or people of colour, we need to address the question of what Jews actually are, because, you know, white and black are really examples of race, aren't they, not ethnicity, and Jews are generally acknowledged to be a sort of ethno-religion. So, like, are Jews a race, an ethnicity, a religion, a culture, a sort of nation, or just a loose tribe or people? And how do they slip between these definitions?
My book and what I talk about in the Jews Don't Count thesis is about racism. And racism does not require the minority concerned to be objectively or anthropologically or scientifically a race. Because what you sometimes get from people who are desperate to, you know, mark down, to degrade the notion of anti-Semitism, is they often say, well, this can't be racism because Jews are not a race, they're not objectively a race or whatever. And you can argue they are. I believe that on my, you know, Ancestry.com profile, I am 99% Ashkenazi Jew. And I think, you know, Jews are generally, in terms of their DNA profile, tribal. But that's not important. What is important is that over centuries and centuries of centuries, Jews have been racialized. We have had a racial idea imposed upon Jews. So whether Jews are an ethnicity or a people or not, what I'm talking about in the book and what we should be talking about is how do we fight racism? In this case, how do we fight anti-Semitism? And it is not important whether or not Jews are objectively X or Y or whatever. What is important is history again and again and again comes back to the idea of classifying Jews as an alien and or inferior race. What I believe I've said like 1,000 times is that I am an atheist, but the Gestapo would kill me tomorrow. And similarly, the men in America now chanting the Jews will not replace us. They would not ask me if I kept kosher before they set light to my house. They don't care about my identity is the point. Racists do not care about how Jews identify. They identify Jews as a specific.
And if you converted, it doesn't assuage the issue.
Yeah, and by the way, that's exactly the same as the way other races are treated. Other races might be more objectively, obviously, a race, but in terms of racism, it doesn't matter. Race is a construct. We are all, you know, in some utopia, just human beings. But the minute that some white racist says that black people are an inferior race, they are racializing those people and imposing a racist idea on them, right?
And they can't just say, I'm not black. I've changed my mind.
That's objectively clearly not true, right? But it's the same process by which any of us might suddenly be described as sort of evil vermin in control of the world, right? That is just imposing a stereotypical racist idea on our individual identity, which will be different and human and various and whatever. I mean, by the way, there are many Jews of colour. My niece is a mixed race Jew of colour, and you know there are lots of Jews of colour and lots of different types of actual melanin within the skin of Jews, as we've discussed.
A lot of Ashkenazi Jews, the majority, identify as being white, don't they?
So, well, yes, yeah, some do identify as being white, but I think the key element of whiteness is that whiteness is not really about the color of your skin. You know, even people who are writing, very progressive people writing, you know, have Robert D'Angelo writing White Fragility or whatever. What they're saying about whiteness is that whiteness is a mark of security, right? Essentially of power, but of security. If you're white, you are safe within the majority that you exist in, and you will not be subjected to violence and discrimination and down the line genocide because you are white. This is a marker of your belonging to that culture. Jews can never completely have that, so therefore we can never be completely white. So I would describe Jews as not quite white.
I'll just quote Dee Badil and just say we're a glitch in the binary.
There's an expression, spicy white, that I've heard, which is white with a twist.
That sounds like a type of coffee.
That was part one of our Principle of Charity conversation. But join us next week for part two, where Lloyd will meet the guests on the couch and try and extract the alternative view. But first, a word from our partners.
The Ethics Centre is an independent not-for-profit that for over 30 years has advocated for a more ethical society. Through all our work, we bring people together, create space for difficult conversations, and encourage all to live and act according to their values. Check out our website for free access to articles, podcasts, and videos that unpack the complexities of everyday life at www.ethics.org.au.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.